This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
Thanks, Ellen, and thank you to the organisers of this conference. It's very exciting for me to be at a conference in which there are no fewer than three papers on Hades. That never happens. Okay, this is one of those papers that has wandered away from its abstract, so bear with me. Hades is arguably the paradigmatic nether god. His separation not only from the human sphere, but also from most other gods, makes him highly unusual. And at the same time, his power and time are unarguable. This combination of great capacity and almost total isolation makes him very unusual among the major gods. His status is made clear in one of the very few myths concerning him, and that is the myth of the allotment of time between Hades, Zeus, and Poseidon. To Zeus, the heavens and divine rule, to Poseidon, the sea, and to Hades, the underworld and the dead. The myth first appears in the Iliad when Poseidon, angered by Zeus's threats against him, asserts his equality to his elder brother, and this is handout one. All was divided among us three ways, each given his domain. I, when the lots were shaken, drew the grey sea to live in forever. Hades drew the lot of the mists and darkness, and Zeus was allotted the wide sky and the cloud and the bright air. But Earth and high Olympus are common to all three. Poseidon clearly envisages that the three lots on offer are at least roughly equivalent in value, since he uses the myth to establish his parity to Zeus in strength and status. The rule over the underworld, therefore, is a significant time for Hades and cements his importance as one of the more powerful gods in the Greek pantheon. However, the Iliadic account establishes not only the balance of power between the three, but also the separation of their spheres of influence. The three gods generally keep out of each other's domains, preferring to meet, if at all, on the neutral ground of the earth or Olympus, but more often communicating by messenger. One of the causes of Poseidon's anger against Zeus is that Zeus is dictating to him about his actions within this neutral, shared sphere. For Hades, there is an additional barrier. It is in the nature of Hades' sphere, with its strict isolation of the living from the dead, that he rarely leaves the underworld, even though he is capable of it. Consequently, he has few myths associated with him, and almost no cult, at least under the name Hades. I see Ellen smiling. His brother Zeus, on the other hand, looks like his antithesis in every respect. Where Hades is isolated, Zeus is all-pervasive. His spheres of influence, such as sovereignty, justice, xenia, and so forth, touch every aspect of human life. His cults are many and varied, and his myths are legion. Yet the distinction between them is not as sharp as one might expect. Zeus has epiklesis, cult names, which embody underworld aspects. Zeus Melikios is the best known, although he's not the subject of this paper. And Hades, primarily but not solely under the name Pluton, has a strong connection with the upper world, and in particular with agricultural prosperity. In this paper, I would like first to look at some of the areas in which the foremost Olympian meets this paradigmatic nether god, both in myth and in cult. I will start with a broad sweep to show just how flexible and how useful this blurring of boundaries can be. Then I would like to focus more closely on death and agriculture. In particular, I want to take a closer look at Zeus Chthonios, a god who arguably does both. And finally, I will abandon Zeus altogether and look at Pluton, another god who arguably does both. The identification of Hades as the underworld Zeus, or some variant thereon, has a long pedigree. Already in the Iliad, Hades is referred to as Zeus Katechthonios, underworld Zeus, in a context which makes it clear that he must be Hades, as Zeus Katechthonios and honoured Persephone fulfil a curse invoked through the Erinues. This is handout two. The use of the name Zeus in association with the Erinues may be intended to evoke Zeus's justice. In Aeschylus' Suppliants, the Danaids threaten the sons of Aegyptus with another Zeus, Steus Allos, in Hades, who pronounces final judgment on the dead for their sins. Having noted that the underworld Zeus, the ever-hospitable Zeus of the departed, ton gaion, ton poluk, senorta ton stena, will receive them if the all-seeing Zeus, that is, the Olympian one, and his daughter Artemis, fail to do so. Aeschylus, perhaps not surprisingly, offers the most complex manipulations of the trope, making full use of its possibilities for confusion between the two gods. In the great Comos of the Koephori, in handout three, I've given you a chunk of this, Orestes appeals to Zeus, who sends up from below avenging ruin, Artan. There is no scholarly consensus over who is meant here. Zeus here is apparently his double Hades, says A.F. Garvey. No, says Alban Lesky. It must be Zeus, since he is everywhere in control, and scholars are more or less split down the middle on this. The chorus respond with a savage wish to see both Aegisthus and Clytemnestra dead. 10 lines later, Electra invokes Zeus and Hades in a single breath, asking, when will almighty Zeus lay his hand upon them, splitting their heads? I am demanding justice in place of injustice. Hear me, earth, and you honoured gods below. The almighty splitter of heads will be Zeus rather than Hades, but the honoured gods below, Chthonion and Timae, will be Hades and Persephone. In response, the chorus assure her that Anerinoes will bring forth yet more blood for the blood already spilt, and Orestes then calls upon the rulers of the underworld, Nerto and Tyrannides, and the curses of the dead, Araete, Thiton, that is again Hades, Persephone and the Runaways, and then, overwhelmed and despairing, cries out, O Zeus, where can one turn? Appeals to Zeus thus appear in the beginning, the middle and the end of this section of the Comos. Only the first one is truly ambiguous in terms of his identity, Hades or Zeus, but the whole passage binds the two gods together in the dark business of bloody retribution. R.P. Winnington Ingram perceptively notes that the two gods cannot be kept apart when an Olympian god, in the execution of his justice, insists upon blood for blood. The glue holding them together is the Erinoes, administrators of Zeus's punitive justice, who are dark and vengeful underworld figures at this point, their name here surrounded by blood and bracketed in the text by Hades and Persephone. The deliberate ambiguity of Zeus and Hades in this passage, in which both are associated with the Erinoes, and it is not clear which of the two is setting them in motion, is possible because the boundary between the two was already permeable. One more example from Aeschylus. In the Agamemnon, Hades is referred to as Zeus Kata Chthonos, protector of the dead under the earth, by Clytemnestra as she stabs her husband for the third time, this is handout 4, and when he had fallen, I added a third stroke in thanksgiving to the Zeus of the underworld, the saviour of the dead, for the fulfilment of my prayers. Here the invocation as Zeus serves a very specific purpose. The phrase, triten dios solteros, evokes the third libation after a feast traditionally offered to Zeus Solter, who is a significant figure in the Oresteia. Zeus Solter is here not only warped into the paradoxical Necron Solteros, the saviour of the dead, but is also the recipient not of a peaceful libation, but of a murderous offering of familial blood. The phrase katakthonos, in contrast to the innocuous katakthonios in the Iliad, now becomes a striking impiety against both Zeus and Hades. Eduard Frankl describes these lines as perhaps the most powerful example of grandiose blasphemy in Aeschylus. Like the passage from the Iliad, these passages evoke Hades under Zeus's name in connection, implicitly or explicitly, with justice or retribution. This is not always the case, however. An epigram from the Greek anthology invokes infernal Zeus, Udaio Stani, to receive tomb offerings, so a straightforward equivalent to Hades. And a fragment of Euripides appeals to the god, these references are handout 5, you, ruler of all, whether you favour the name Zeus or Hades, for you wield the sceptre of Zeus amongst the gods of heaven, and also share with Hades the rule of those within the earth. This is a necromantic fragment as it goes on to ask the god to send into the light the souls of the dead. The association between Zeus and Hades is persistent enough to be known to Pausanias, quite a lot later, who uses it to explain a statue of Zeus with three eyes, suggesting that the eyes signal that Zeus rules in all the three allotments, sky, sea, underworld, usually also allocated to Poseidon and Hades. Exactly why Zeus can thus regularly serve as a substitute for Hades is open to discussion. Pausanias' rationale would indicate that, as Timothy Gant suggests, at times Zeus and Hades represented simply different facets of a single extended divine power. In other words, Zeus can stand in for Hades because he can, in effect, stand in for anything or anyone. In contrast to this rather wholesale approach, we've seen in the Aeschylean examples that the ambiguity between Zeus and Hades stems from the ambiguity of divine justice itself, since Zeus's agents of punishment, the Erinoes, are rooted deep in Hades' world. So for Aeschylus, it is one particular focused aspect of Zeus's character that makes him a fitting name for Hades and vice versa. As usual then, a one-size-fits-all approach to the sources will not work. For one thing, literary usage of names and epithets rejoices in exploiting exactly this kind of ambiguity. I don't think it's a coincidence that so many of my examples of this come from tragedy. In cult titles, on the other hand, we might expect to find more precise usage. The worshipper needs to be exact in his or her choice of god and epiclesis, since effective prayer and ritual depends on getting the name of the god right. With this in mind, let's take a closer look at the epithet chthonios. It means, of course, of the earth, in, under, beneath, or sprung from it. Hence its associations with both agriculture and the dead. Chthonios and the modern word chthonic have caused more than their fair share of problems in translation and interpretation, as I'm sure you all know. I am going to avoid the controversy around the use and meaning of the modern word chthonic by not using the word at all. I will just say that any attempt at a tidy reductive definition of a set group of chthonic deities is bound to fail, since it goes against the grain of the flexible and messy agglomeration of systems that is Greek religion. The ancient Greek adjective chthonios has two main areas of meaning, and I'm sure you can all argue with me about this later on. The first has to do with the underworld, so it is applied to the dead, to cult heroes, and to gods who are underworld related, as well as Zeus, Hades, Hecate, Hermes, and the Erinues, among others, bear the epiclesis, examples in handout 6. Alternatively, or secondarily, chthonios has to do with the earth, which heroes may also fall in this group, so it's already getting messy. And in this area, it has an association with agriculture. Zeus Chthonios is the god to whom Hesiod urges the farmer to appeal before he begins sowing his crops alongside Demeter. So pray to Zeus Chthonios and to hallowed Demeter to make Demeter's holy grain ripe and heavy as you begin ploughing at the very start. Now, Sarah S. Johnston sees Zeus Chthonios in this passage as simply a euphemism for Hades. But this doesn't seem the most obvious meaning of Chthonios here. M.L. West sees Zeus Chthonios here as an extension of Zeus or a chthonic counterpart of Zeus, which pretty much covers all the bases without narrowing down the options very much. On the face of it, however, it looks like this Zeus has an agricultural function and need not be underworld related at all. Similarly, Demeter Chthonia is cited in Apollonius as the goddess who taught the Titans to harvest the bountiful grain, and the island of Corcyra is known as Drepane, sickle, after the instrument with which she did it. The cult of Demeter Chthonia and Hermione, on the other hand, introduces an underworld element, although this does not exclude an agrarian purpose. As Ellen said yesterday, it's right opposite a temple to Clymenos, who Pausanias tells us is Hades, and behind it are three places for Clymenos, Pluton, and the Acherusian Lake, so it's surrounded by underworld stuff. Although the peculiarities of the ritual there make it difficult to interpret the goddess's function, as we saw yesterday, it's certainly true to say that the place and the other gods who have a presence there are strongly linked to the underworld. The same is likely to be true of the only other known cult of Demeter Chthonia in Sparta. The Spartans told Pausanias it was handed down to them by Orpheus, though Pausanias thinks it more likely to have been adopted from the cult at Hermione. Either of these options is indicative of an eschatological function. And finally, as Ellen noted in her appendix, Demeter Chthonia appears on a gold leaf, a passport to the underworld. Send me to the Thiasoi of the Mystai. I have the ritual objects of Bacchios and the rites of Demeter Chthonia and the Mountain Mother. Whatever she's doing here, she must be underworld related in this context. But of course, Chthonios need not have only one of these meanings at a time. When Herodotus describes Demeter and Kore as Chthoniae Theae in passing and without further explanation, either association or both could be apposite. I noted at the outset that a worshipper needs to choose the correct epiclesis in order to get what he needs, but even in cult, there is room for play on the possible meanings of Chthonios, both to do with the underworld and to do with the earth and agriculture. For a goddess such as Persephone, who so clearly is Chthonia in both senses of the word, the broad scope of the title fits perfectly. The dead and the underworld do have an association with agricultural growth, and the word Chthonios is capable of neatly encapsulating that. How then do we take the cult of Zeus Chthonios? We know there was one, as well as the sewing prayer mentioned in Hesiod. He had an altar at Olympia, and he had a statue at Corinth. Unfortunately, information on what the god actually did or what his worshippers expected of him is scarce, to say the least. In Mykonos, an inscription tells us that Zeus Chthonios and Gaia Chthonia, this is over the page in your handout, but it is in there, received sacrifice of a yearling black ram for the fruits, hyperkarpon, so for the sake of the crops, something like that. The meat is consumed on site by those present, and foreigners are excluded. Martin Nielsen argued that the sacrifice is not an expiatory one, concluding it is therefore harder to associate the Zeus Chthonios of cult with Hades. On the other hand, it has just enough deviations from the sacrificial norm, if there is one, a black victim that's eaten on site, so no one's allowed to take the meat away, to make it questionable. Since the god does not appear in cult-related inscriptions, these four pieces of evidence constitute the sum total of our knowledge of the cult of Zeus Chthonios. That's it. Our evidence for his cult is thus exceedingly limited, but in contrast to the literary non-cult sources which mention the god, the indication is of a fairly narrow agricultural spectrum, Chthonios in the agricultural rather than the underworld sense. In literary sources, however, the god has stronger links to Hades. In Sophocles' Oedipus at Kolonos, it is Zeus Chthonios who oversees Oedipus' heroisation, encouraging him with thunderclap and an impatient shout. And the statue at Corinth, I mentioned a moment ago, is one of a set of three. Pausanias tells us that one is Zeus Chthonios, one is Zeus Hypsistos, that is Zeus the highest, and the third has no epiclesis. F.G. Welker, among others, took this as referring to the allotment myth and suggested the third was Zeus Poseidon, although it is unlikely that the epiclesis would be left out in that case. Nonetheless, the antithesis between the highest Zeus and the one from the underworld is tempting. Nor can we really separate Zeus Chthonios from Zeus Katachthonios, who, as we saw in handout two, is unequivocally Hades. It's possible that the cult of Zeus Chthonios is solely agrarian, but the strongly marked underworld associations of the literary sources indicate at least a potential affinity with Hades. Even given that this is a small sample, the disjunction is striking. I'd like to suggest that the cult is primarily agrarian, but with a subtle aroma of underworld about it. I will come back to how this might actually work in practice at the end of this paper. The second case I want to consider is also a god who does, I think, have a connection with both agriculture and the underworld, a god who crosses the boundary between the world of the dead and the world of the living, and that is Pluton. I will look primarily at the Eleusinian Mysteries, since we know more about Pluton in that context than any other, which is not saying much. I should make clear at the outset that I do, unlike Ellen, I do think that one of the primary functions of the Eleusinian Mysteries was eschatological. So I'm starting from that premise and we can argue about it later. So first, a quick look at the myth which underlies the cult, which is, of course, the abduction of Persephone by Hades and Demeter's subsequent search for her. One would expect that Hades might be the villain of this particular story. After all, he snatches Persephone and thus sets Zeus and Demeter at odds, not to mention causing famine amongst men. But in fact, he tends to come out of the story rather well. I'll use the Homeric hymn to Demeter as an example, since it's our longest extant version, and I think it has an affinity with the Mysteries. I don't think it's etiological for it, but I think there's an affinity there. As the Homeric hymn to Demeter relates the story, Zeus plans the marriage of Persephone and Demeter is kept in the dark. That's the usual thing. Hades does not seem to be the instigator of the plan. It is Zeus who gives Persephone, Dorken, line 3, and again at line 78 to 9, and Gaia produces the flower to snare Persephone by Zeus's will, Buliesi, line 9. The first line 9s are in your handout, 8. The ensuing contest is not between Demeter and Hades, but between Demeter and Zeus. It is Demeter who forces Zeus to revisit his decision, and it is Zeus who adjudicates the final outcome. Everyone stays in their proper roles and places. Hades does not leave the underworld and incidentally shows no interest whatsoever in agriculture. Demeter does not enter the underworld, and Zeus stays put on remote Olympus, controlling events through Iris, Hermes, and the others. It is, of course, crucial to the myth that the barrier between the world of the gods and the underworld is solid and impassable. It would spoil the plot if Demeter could just pop down and pick up her daughter at any moment. But by the end of the hymn, some of these boundaries have been renegotiated. Hades is no longer entirely isolated. He now has a link to the living through his wife, even though the newly permeable boundary is very much in her purview rather than his. So several scholars have also commented on the favourable presentation of Hades in the poem, and particularly on his conciliatory approach to Persephone, something that also appears in later versions, as he asks her not to be aggrieved and offers her power both in the underworld and amongst the living. The poem makes no bones about his dark attributes and his grim home, but the epithets used of him are not derogatory. Persephone herself is arguably something of a pawn in the process. She has no say in the disposal of her person, although she does have an opinion. The hymn is ambivalent over whether Persephone is ultimately content with her marriage. Later traditions offer a range of answers. In Virgil, Persephone asserts her free will and doesn't want to return. In Lucan, Demeter doesn't want her back. In any event, Persephone herself gains by the deal. She receives Temai over both the living and the dead. Persephone is the key in these myths, in spite of her passive role. She is the pivot around which the others revolve, the contested object, the tie between her underworld husband and her mother. So also, Kore is the crucial link in the mysteries. She was the queen of the underworld, and yet her role as daughter of Demeter, goddess of the harvest, tied together the mysteries' older agricultural antecedents with its presence, its promises of a better afterlife. The mysteries are prominent in both areas because so is Kore. Her return opens up the possibility of communication between the worlds of the living and the dead, and along with it, the possibility of gaining her favour in both of her two roles. Hades does not appear under that name in the mysteries. Rather, he has cult there primarily under the name Pluton, the wealthy one, a name connected with agricultural prosperity rather than death. The most important figures in the cult were Demeter and Kore, but Pluton did have a significant presence. He probably had an altar alongside theirs near the entrance to Eleusis, and he had a precinct, the Plutoneion, and a temple at the city Eleusinian in Athens, not in Eleusis, and he also had a priestess of his own. The offerings he received were substantial. He received a Triton Bouarchon, a sacrifice of three victims led by a bull, the same as Demeter and Kore. The references for this are somewhere on your handout. I haven't written it down. So he did have status. The role which Pluton played in the cults of Demeter and Kore is unclear, and it is complicated by the fact that there was probably another instantiation of Hades who also received cult at Eleusis. Theos and Thea, the god and the goddess, are attested in a series of inscriptions and votive offerings. Kevin Clinton has argued, I think rightly, for a separation between Pluton and Kore as divinities connected with agriculture, and Theos and Thea as their underworld counterparts equivalent to Hades and Persephone. The very unspecific names, Theos and Thea, god and goddess, serve as a kind of euphemistic appellation, a polite way of referring to a couple who are underworld related and therefore potentially dangerous. In other words, when the pair are doing their above ground agrarian thing, they are Pluton and Kore. When they are doing their underworld thing, they are Theos and Thea. Theos and Thea also had their own priest, shared with Eubuleus, who is a whole other problem, and received offerings in the cave precinct just to the north of the main entrance to the sanctuary at Eleusis. For those of you who know Eleusis, it's the area which used to be thought of as the Plutoneion. The cave certainly had links to the underworld. It is very likely to be the cave in the Deme of Eleusis where the gates of Hades are, mentioned in an Orphic hymn. It has a narrow, almost inaccessible inner cave about 5 metres deep, at the end of which were the remains of sacrifices of oxen and sheep and offerings to Theos, Thea, and Eubuleus. So given that Theos is the underworld Hades, if we give that, what can we tell about Pluton? The character of Pluton is nicely illustrated by his appearance in Attic vase painting, and I've given you a couple of examples in handout 10, though the observant among you will notice that the first vase is a hydria, not an amphora. Sorry about that. Certainly this is not a terrible god of the underworld. Kore shows no fear of him, and in fact the goddesses sometimes make gestures of homage towards him. He also appears in scenes such as the dispatch of Triptolemus, which place him firmly in the mortal world. Like Kore then, he is apparently able to act outside of the underworld. This is notably different from the myth in which, when Persephone returns to the upper world, Hades stays behind in the underworld. Now, Clinton's identifications are plausible and persuasive. However, Clinton argues for a more absolute break between the two pairs than I would, suggesting that Pluton is solely a god of agricultural wealth. However, as Robert Parker has pointed out, What is missing is evidence for the postulated Pluton, who is a pure god of agricultural wealth, unassociated with the underworld. Certainly outside of the cult context, the name Pluton has underworldly associations. It becomes almost completely interchangeable with the name Hades. For example, in Euripides' Alcestis, Admetus speaks in the same breath of fetching Alcestis from Hades and not being put off by Pluton's hound. And once again, writers make the most of the ambiguity of the name, the wealthy one. Sophocles' Oedipus, speaking of the plague that is ravaging Thebes, laments that black Hades is wealthy, Plutistitai, in groans and laments. Whereas Aristophanes asks, and how would he ever have gotten the name Pluton if he hadn't had the best of everything? The question is whether we can trace any sign of this underworld association in the Eleusinian Pluton, or whether he is in fact purely agricultural. I want to point to two objects with which he is associated, which I think cross the boundary between agriculture and the underworld. The first is the cornucopia. Pluton often carries it in Attic vase painting. I've given an example, the first example on the handout, in which the god in question is hopefully identified by the company he keeps, the Eleusinian deities Demeter, Corre, Triptolemus, and Hecate. The cornucopia is undeniably an effective symbol of agricultural prosperity, full of fruit and leaves. But as I've argued elsewhere, it's not only that. Pluton is its first and principal bearer, but from the 4th century, the cornucopia develops a life of its own. It may be found in the hands of figures such as the Agathos Daimon, the hero Melicertes Palaemon, Heracles, Pancrates, Zeus Melikios, and Zeus Philios. This is quite a nice list of nether gods. The last three, as their names imply, the all-conquering one, kindly Zeus, and friendly Zeus, are all deities closely associated with the underworld. If you ever come across a god who's got an epiclesis meaning friendly or kindly or generous, be afraid, that's probably masking something horrible. Even Heracles, as an immortalized hero, has much to do with Hades and his realm in the course of his life. These are all, one way and another, figures who are connected to Hades and the house of Hades, arguably. None of the Olympians carries a cornucopia, and certainly neither Persephone nor Demeter ever holds one. There's also the question of what's in it. The round thing in the hydria on the handout is very common, but nobody is certain what these are. Catherine Bremen describes them as small, round, unidentifiable fruit. Poppy heads, pomegranates, and honey cakes are three likely suggestions. All of these are good underworldly objects, and rather than not really associated with useful harvest. On rare occasions, such as the Kylix Tondo, the second image on your handout, the god can even carry an empty cornucopia, which would seem a perfect attribute for a god whose function is part agricultural prosperity and part death. On that particular vase, the god is actually labelled Pluton, so we know we're not dealing with Hades here. The second item, which may indicate a link between Pluton and death, is his association with Plimacoi in cult. Plimacoi are a type of oil flask offered to underworld deities. Athenaeus associates the shape specifically with the Mysteries, and this is handout 11. He says it is used as Eleusis on the final day of the Mysteries, which is accordingly referred to as Plimacoi. On this day, they fill two plimacoi, and standing facing east in the case of one and facing west in the case of the other, they turn them upside down, reciting a formula associated with the Mysteries. They are mentioned by the author of the Pirithous, who says the following: in order that we may silently pour these plimacoi into the chasm in the earth. Numerous fragments of plimacoi have been found around the city Eleusinian. They are found at Eleusis and in central Athens almost exclusively, primarily around the Eleusinian and in the Kerameikos Cemetery. Interestingly, the other place they turn up is in Alexandria, where there was a copycat cult of the Eleusinian Mysteries. Plimacoi are depicted in relief sculptures both at Eleusis and in the city Eleusinian, as well as on coins minted for the festival. 8 deposits of plimacoi were found at the southern end of the city Eleusinian. One of them was a deliberate burial of intact plimacoi, which would indicate that sanctuary officials were involved. This is also a likely area for the Plutonian, the shrine of Pluton. The shrine has not definitely been identified, but 2 dedications to Pluton were found on the slope of the Acropolis above the Agora, much of which is still unexcavated. The naming of the last day of the Mysteries as Plimacoi may indicate that an important part of this day was given over to libations to underworld-related deities. Pluton is the most likely candidate here, given his presence at the Eleusinion, though Theos is also possible. None of this is what one would call conclusive evidence that Pluton had an underworld aspect, although I think it is indicative. It also doesn't tell us anything about how Pluton operated elsewhere outside of the mysteries. In the cult at Hermione, for example, even though we know less, his link to the underworld is clearer, again because of the company he keeps, Clymenos and the Acherusian Lake. But, assuming for the moment that I'm right, and that Pluton and Zeus Chthonios were agrarian deities with underworld affinities, how might that actually play out in cult? What are the expectations of a worshipper who is approaching this kind of god? There certainly were cults in which Hades, under whatever name, clearly had a foot in both agricultural and underworld camps, and I want to finish by giving you one example of that. A refreshingly clear example, which comes from a cult Intraphilia mentioned by Strabo. This is handout 12. And he says, the Acheron, the river Acheron, Intraphilia, has been so named by virtue of its close relation to Hades, for as we know, not only the temples of Demeter and Kore have been held in very high honour there, but also those of Hades, part perhaps because of the contrariness of the soil. For while Triphilia brings forth good fruit, it breeds red rust and rush. It breeds red rust and produces rush. It's a tongue twister. And therefore, in its region, it is often the case that instead of a large crop, there is no crop at all. The association with Demeter and Kore and the whole tenor of Strabo's description makes it clear that this is an agricultural cult in which Hades is also involved. The triad Demeter, Kore, Pluton, or Demeter, Kore, Clymenos, is common enough to make the close connection between Demeter and Hades comprehensible, if unusual. We can take Hades as a kind of equivalent to Pluton, though not necessarily identical. But it's worth noting that the area, as described by Strabo, is not straightforwardly fertile. It's also subject to disease. Moreover, Hades' influence has extended far enough to have one of the rivers, Acheron, named for the underworld. So in what way does the presence of Hades ensure a good harvest? It seems likely that this is one of those instances when one god gives and another takes away. Demeter has the harvest in her purview, whereas Hades has red rust and rush. Hades is the destructive flip side of Demeter's generosity. Cult is offered to please her and to improve the harvest and to placate him and reduce disease. Hades is thus beneficent only insofar as he restrains his ability to cause the destruction of the crop. Even though he is a god of agricultural wealth, this destructive potential allies him also with his role as the Lord of the Dead. I would like to suggest tentatively that something of the sort may be operating with the cults of Zeus Chthonios and Pluton. Both gods operate within agricultural cults, and yet both in different ways have affinities with the underworld. Both stem from a blurring of boundaries between the nether god Hades and an Olympian deity, Zeus in the case of Zeus Chthonios, Demeter in the case of Pluton, although Kore remains the mediator here. We cannot say for certain whether the Hades element of these two gods resulted in the kind of potential for destruction which characterised Hades in the cult of Triphilia, but it would be a plausible mode of operation for two gods of that kind of mixed character. The title of the paper included The Farmer, the Ruler and the God of Death. I hope at least to have shown that it's not always entirely clear which is which. Thank you.